Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show that extracts the most essential nuggets of knowledge from the overwhelming flow of federal news. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. It's good to be here.
Today, we're doing something a little different. We are setting out to conduct a truly exhaustive, granular deep dive.
We're looking at every significant action, every activity of the U.S. federal government, starting from Saturday, December 13th, right through the close of business today, Monday, December 15th, 2025.
And that 72-hour period, it wasn't just busy. I mean, it's foundational. It signaled a massive, synchronized restructuring of federal priorities. We saw it across national security, immigration, deregulation.
And the courts. We're not just looking at what happened, but really unpacking the immediate and, you know, the long-term implications of these lightning-fast moves.
So we're calling this Deep Dive, the federal news update for Monday, December 15th, 2025.
And we have to jump right in with what is, I think, arguably the most dramatic and symbolic shift we've seen in the national security apparatus this year.
Okay, let's get right into it. The formalization of an ideological pivot that, let's be honest, many saw coming, but maybe not this fast. The Department of Defense, the DOD, it's officially gone.
Replaced by the Department of War, or DOW. And look, this is so much more than just changing the name on a building, Alex.
It has to be.
It's a profound institutional and really a cultural transformation, and it's being driven directly from the top. We saw the evidence immediately after business closed on Friday, and it was confirmed in memos all weekend.
And the most visible signal for everyone is the digital one.
That's right. The central hub for the U.S. military online is now war.gov. The old defense.gov domain has been completely replaced.
And that language, war, it's so deliberate. It tells the entire story for almost 80 years.
Since 1947, yeah.
Since 1947, the name Department of Defense implied a certain posture. It was technocratic. It was about deterrence, reaction.
A defensive posture, by definition. By shifting back to war, you're deliberately hearkening back to the pre-National Security Act era. It's an explicit signal of active engagement, of imposing will on the world stage.
That's the ideological core, isn't it?
It is. And the DOW's own internal documents, they cement this. Directives from the new Secretary of War emphasize a specific warrior ethos.
What does that mean in practice, a warrior ethos?
It signals a rejection of what they see as a budget-focused managerial culture that sort of permeated the Pentagon for decades. The goal is to create a combat-centric identity for the entire institution. Military action isn't a last resort anymore.
It's framed as a primary function of state power.
Exactly.
But isn't a war posture like that inherently risky, not just diplomatically, but also internally? I'm thinking about transparency, the free press.
It is, and that clash was immediate. The DOW transition came with a major operational change on information control.
How so?
We learned that the Department of War has imposed severe new restrictions on the press. Reporters covering the Pentagon now have to sign these new agreements.
Agreements that do what?
That grant the DOW expansive control over what information can be published. Several major media organizations are already challenging them, saying they flat out contravene the First Amendment.
So the new war paradigm includes controlling the narrative.
A very highly curated narrative. And that new paradigm was stress tested almost immediately by a crisis in Syria.
Let's turn to that, because it was the first, and tragically, a deadly test for the brand new DOW. And it happened just hours after that formal shift. We're talking about an incident near Palmyra, Syria, on Saturday.
A deadly ambush. It resulted in the loss of two U.S. Army soldiers and one American civilian interpreter.
Do we know who they were?
Yes. The soldiers were identified as Sergeant Edgar Brian Torres Tovar and Sergeant William Nathaniel Howard. Both were serving with the Iowa National Guard. Three other service members were wounded in the attack.
A terrible loss. But the really critical long-term vulnerability this exposed wasn't just the attack itself, but the source of the attack.
Exactly. This wasn't a standard assault by some known enemy faction. This was a major insider threat.
An insider threat.
Correct. Intelligence reports that crystallized today, on Monday, confirmed what's being called a catastrophic vetting failure.
So who was the attacker?
He was identified as a known ISIS sympathizer who had been successfully recruited into the Syrian Internal Security Forces about 2 months ago.
Wow. Okay, so that is a huge problem.
It's a crucial detail. It exposes the extreme fragility of the U.S. partnership with the new Syrian government, the one led by President Ahmed al-Shara.
And the administration has invested a lot of geopolitical capital in that new Syrian order, right? They see it as a necessary buffer.
A bulwark against both Iran and Russia in the region, yes.
So if the partner they are relying on, the Syrian state itself, is already compromised by ISIS, admitting that would force a whole policy review. It could jeopardize their entire investment. How did the president navigate that?
His response, delivered the next day, was a textbook example of what you might call diplomatic decoupling.
Diplomatic decoupling. Unpack that.
Well, while he was very swift and decisive in promising very serious retaliation against the specific ISIS cell responsible, he went to extraordinary lengths to completely exonerate the Syrian government itself.
What was his rhetorical focus specifically?
He explicitly said the bad people were ISIS, not the Syrian government. He made a point of emphasizing that President al-Sharaa was personally devastated by the attack and that Syrian forces were, quote, fighting along with us.
So it's a strategic rhetorical framing.
Absolutely. By separating the attack from the state, he preserves the political narrative that their investment in the al-Sharaa government is sound. It lets the administration maintain its geopolitical alignment.
So to put a finer point on it, the decision is to prioritize the bigger, long-term strategic game containing Moscow and Tehran over admitting a huge failure in vetting.
Exactly. The refusal to acknowledge that state compromise protects the policy, even if it means ignoring the facts on the ground.
And the markets reacted to this potential for escalation almost immediately, didn't they?
They did. When U.S. markets opened today, Monday, they reflected that geopolitical anxiety. The S&P 500 opened lower, and maybe more tellingly, gold started approaching all-time highs.
Investors rushing to safe haven assets.
Right. They're reacting both to the Syrian news and, you know, to this new, more kinetic Department of War posture in general.
But on the other side of that coin, that same posture is probably driving investment elsewhere.
Of course. We saw upward pressure on defense contractor stocks across the board, the anticipation of retaliation against ISIS, plus the clear signal of increased military engagement that the DOW implies. While institutional investors are pricing in higher profits for the big defense firms, it's a direct financial consequence.
A truly radical restructuring of foreign policy.
Right.
And now we pivot to the domestic front, where an equally radical restructuring is underway. This time it's about who gets to enter the United States.
It really is a fundamental change in the American immigration ethos, and it's being driven by a massive policy reset from the Department of Homeland Security.
And it's just dropped today.
It did, via a Federal Register notice. And it represents one of the most consequential changes to legal immigration pathways that we've seen in decades. Today, December 15th, BHS announced the immediate termination of all categorical family reunification parole programs, FRP.
Okay, can you detail the scope of this? Who is specifically targeted by this termination?
The termination targets nationals from 7 specific countries: Colombia, Cuba, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, and Honduras.
And these FRP programs have been a real lifeline for people.
They were. They allowed family members of U.S. citizens or legal residents who had approved visa petitions to wait safely inside the U.S. for their final visas to become available. And because of these huge backlogs, that wait can be years long.
So what's the core legal argument the administration is using to just end these programs?
The rationale is it's purely statutory. The administration argues that granting parole on a categorical basis, meaning to whole groups of people based on their nationality, violates the Immigration and Nationality Act.
And the INA says what?
That parole has to be granted only on a case-by-case basis, considering an urgent humanitarian need for each individual applicant. By just declaring the programs categorical, they can void them all at once.
And the timeline here is, it's brutal.
It is. The termination sets a very hard deadline. Everyone currently under these programs, their parole status will expire on January 14th, 2026.
That is just 1 month away.
Exactly. It suggests immediate massive disruption for thousands of families and, frankly, the industries that rely on their labor.
But to manage the fallout, DHS did include a critical savings clause in the notice. What does that exemption cover?
This is a crucial detail for anyone listening who's directly affected by this. To avoid the logistical nightmare of immediate mass removal proceedings, DHS created an exemption.
And that is?
Individuals who filed Form I-485, that's the application to adjust status on or before today, December 15th, are shielded from termination until their application is fully adjudicated.
So it's a small sliver of refuge for those who are already deep in the process.
Right. But it leaves anyone who is waiting to file an impossible situation.
And DHS seems to be trying what they're calling soft enforcement to encourage compliance without, you know, the spectacle of mass raids.
That's right. The strategy avoids the negative optics and the huge costs of mass detention and removal. Instead of ICE raids, they're using departure incentives.
Like what?
Things like offering financial exit bonuses and forgiving civil fines for people who agree to leave voluntarily before that January 14th deadline. It's a deliberate effort to get the numbers down through attrition and incentives, not confrontation.
But no matter the method, the socioeconomic impact on U.S. labor markets is going to be immediate and severe in certain sectors, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The automatic revocation of parole also revokes all the associated employment authorization documents, the EADs.
Which means employers are in a bind.
A huge bind. Employers in labor-intensive industries, I'm thinking agriculture, hospitality, healthcare support, especially in South Florida, the Northeast, the West Coast, they will be legally compelled to terminate thousands of essential workers by mid-January.
And this is happening at the same time that the administration is accelerating wealth-based immigration through the new Gold Card program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the contrast is stark.
It's the clearest example yet of this bifurcated, two-track American entry system. It's the policy equivalent of building a wall for the poor and a frictionless expressway for the rich.
So this Gold Card program, it's an expedited green card track for those with capital.
And it fundamentally reshapes the American ethos of immigration away from family unity and toward capital accumulation.
Let's talk about the financial requirements for this frictionless path. It's not cheap.
Not at all. It demands two non-refundable fees. First, there's a hefty $15,000 processing fee.
And second.
Second, and this is the big one, a mandatory $1 million contribution that goes directly to the Department of Commerce. It is essentially an investment fee paid to the U.S. government for the privilege of immediate residency.
So an explicit prioritization of capital. And this shift seems to align perfectly with the administration's broader strategy of systemic deregulation, which was also launched in full force today.
That is the essential connection here, Alex. The same executive drive that created the Department of War and redefined who gets to enter the country. It's being used to dismantle what the administration sees as burdensome regulations at home.
And we start with the Small Business Administration.
The SBA, now led by Administrator Kelly Loeffler, announced the formation of the Deregulation Strike Force. And this is not some passive advisory board. It has a remarkably broad and powerful mandate.
Explain the scope of this strike force. What's its power?
It operates under the SBA's Office of Advocacy, which has always reviewed regulations, but this new strike force has a mandate to review regulations across the entire federal government.
Including independent agencies.
Yes, and that's the key. It includes agencies that are usually insulated from direct political pressure, like the EPA and OSHA. Their one job is to identify and target rules they see as increasing costs for small businesses.
And the administration is framing this as a move to help with affordability.
Precisely. It's positioned as a core counterinflationary measure, part of their affordability agenda. By explicitly linking what they call Biden-era regulations to the high cost of living, they justify using this to aggressively challenge standards on the environment, labor, safety, you name it.
But the real power is in the new internal structure this creates, isn't it? It gives the SBA an unprecedented ability to challenge other agencies.
It creates a powerful internal veto point. Historically, if the EPA proposed a new emissions rule, the SBA could comment on the cost. Now, this strike force can actively challenge the rulemaking of almost any other federal agency before it's even finalized.
It basically institutionalizes the idea that economic growth takes priority over everything else.
Over regulatory compliance burdens, yes. Things like climate risk disclosures or chemical safety rules, those are likely immediate targets because of the costs they impose on small firms.
And that executive action lines up perfectly with what's happening in the legislative branch. Today, the House Rules Committee moved to advance two huge industrial policy bills.
The first is H.R. 4776, widely known as the SPEED Act. And this is a comprehensive overhaul of the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA.
Before we unpack it, remind our listeners why NEPA is such a big deal. Why is this such a consequential target?
Well, NEPA has been the bedrock of environmental review for major infrastructure projects since 1970. Its original purpose was to force federal agencies to take a hard look at the environmental consequences of their actions before they built anything.
The Environmental Impact Statement process.
Right, the EIS process.
Yeah.
And that often involves public review, and critically, it opens the door for environmental groups to sue, which can delay projects for years. The SPEED Act is designed to systematically neutralize those vulnerabilities.
So how does it do that? What are the key mechanisms?
Three primary things. First, the act severely narrows the definition of a major federal action. It excludes projects with only minimal federal funding, which drastically reduces the number of projects that even need an EIS.
No EIS, no major regulatory hurdle.
Exactly. Second, it deals with the scope of the review itself. It codifies a very strict, reasonably close causal relationship standard.
Which means?
It's technical, but the goal is to make it impossible for agencies to consider distant or downstream impacts. For instance, when reviewing a new pipeline, they can't consider the climate change effects of burning the gas that goes through it. The review is limited just to the construction.
And the third mechanism is seen as the single biggest victory for developers. It's about constraining the courts.
This is absolutely massive. The SPEED Act mandates that courts must now use remand without vacatur when they find a permit was issued illegally.
Okay, remand without vacatur. You have to unpack that for us.
Okay, so normally, if a judge finds an environmental review is flawed, they vacate the permit. That means the permit is nullified. Construction stops instantly. The developer loses tons of money.
But under the SPEED Act,
under the new rule, the judge can only remand the case back to the agency to fix the paperwork, but the judge cannot vacate the permit.
So construction continues.
Construction continues while the paperwork is fixed. The developer's biggest fear, that immediate costly work stoppage, is just gone. It's a game changer.
And the other bill on the agenda today was H.R. 1366, the Mining Regulatory Clarity Act. This is a direct legislative fix.
It is. It's a response to the Rosemont court decision, which was a huge blow to the mining industry. That decision had stopped mine development on public lands if the land needed for waste storage. The tailings didn't itself have valuable minerals,
which constrained the physical footprint of modern mines
severely. So H.R. 1366 fixes that by statutorily redefining mining operations to explicitly include these ancillary sites like waste storage. It grants mining companies the legal right to use that public land.
And the strategic context here is about supply chains.
It's all about breaking reliance on China. The administration sees this as essential to fast-track U.S. mining of critical minerals like lithium and copper. These two bills together are an incredibly aggressive, unified industrial policy agenda.
This intense focus on efficiency and cost-cutting extends into federal real estate, though that effort seems to be hitting some bumps.
It is. The General Services Administration, GSA, has been charged with shrinking the federal footprint. They confirmed today they finalized 260 lease terminations this year, saving about $112 million annually, which sounds good. But the real story is that that number is way below the target set by the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE.
How far below?
Significantly. Sources say GSA only finalized about 30% of the 900 or so termination notices they sent out. Lawmakers are calling it significant chaos and mixed messaging.
The criticism is that the drive for cuts outran planning and operational needs.
Exactly. Agencies were told to vacate space before anyone had gathered reliable data on utilization, or before replacement space was even ready. It created these internal logistical nightmares.
So the efficiency goals created their own inefficiency. And this fits into a much broader, truly staggering crisis with the government's physical infrastructure.
It does. Even as GSA is trying to offload properties, the deferred maintenance and repair backlog on the buildings they own is estimated at $50
billion. $50
billion. And if you zoom out to the entire government, the GAO reports the government-wide backlog. It's more than doubled since 2017. It's now at about $340 billion.
That number, $340 billion, it's so vast it almost loses me. What are we talking about here? Failing systems, crumbling landmarks.
Both. We're talking about critical systems, HVAC, elevators, roofs, which affect safety and operations. But it also includes historic landmarks that need specialized, expensive repairs. And get this, GSA only receives about $600 million a year to address all of that.
They can't possibly keep up.
They're fighting an impossible battle. They can barely touch the interest on that $340 billion debt.
So what's their strategy moving forward?
Disposal and optimization. GSA is requesting $365 million for an optimization fund to help them get rid of more of these underperforming buildings faster. They're trying to push agencies into leased space,
which has its own advantages.
Two big ones. Taxpayers aren't on the hook for decaying properties, and leasing gives agencies more flexibility to meet the new space requirements mandated by Congress.
And those new space requirements are key, aren't they?
Crucially important. They're trying to prepare agencies to meet the mandatory 60% utilization rate required by the USEIT Act.
Which takes effect when?
January 2026, so just over a year from now. And this mandatory occupancy rate is already being used as the justification for these large-scale, sometimes controversial agency moves. The entire federal government is being forced to shrink its physical footprint.
These policy maneuvers are so complex, but they're playing out against a backdrop of deep political and institutional tension. This brings us right into the political and judicial warfare of the past 72 hours.
And we can start with a powerful physical and symbolic metaphor playing out right in Washington.
At the White House itself.
The physical assertion of executive dominance. Reports confirmed on Sunday that the East Wing of the White House isn't just being renovated, it's being systematically demolished.
To build what?
To construct a massive 90,000 square foot ballroom.
And this has already spurred legal action.
Immediate and significant. The National Trust for Historic Preservation has filed a major lawsuit. They're arguing the president lacks the legal authority to unilaterally alter a national historic landmark without consultation or approval.
And it is a potent metaphor for the administration's whole approach to governance.
It really is. The deliberate dismantling of established physical and institutional structures to construct a grander, more unilateral presidency, it's designed to project imperial power.
And this physical renovation seems tied to policy renovation. The president renewed his pledge to replace Obamacare.
He did at a reception on Sunday. And that renewal is key because it ensures that dismantling the Affordable Care Act remains a top active priority. And given the political alignment, they'll almost certainly pursue it through deregulation and executive orders.
Not through Congress.
Not likely. And this unilateral approach is causing immediate and severe friction within the federal workforce, especially over collective bargaining rights.
Right. On the legislative front, we saw a major counteraction last week that's still dominating the discourse.
That would be the passage of the Protect America's Workforce Act in the House. It passed with a bipartisan 231-195 vote on December 11th.
And this bill is a direct counter to the executive branch.
It is. It aims to nullify the president's executive orders that had canceled union contracts for a majority of federal employees across a bunch of agencies.
And the bipartisan nature of that vote, 20 Republicans voting in favor, indicates significant internal pressure.
It does. The opposition, though, focused on the constitutional principle of executive management, arguing the bill threatens the president's authority. But for federal unions, this was a seismic victory.
But the fight moves to the Senate now.
And that's the massive challenge. The unions are urging the Senate to take up the companion bill immediately, but it has minimal Republican support there. Just one co-sponsor, Senator Lisa Murkowski.
So it's a tough, drawn-out legislative battle ahead.
Absolutely. And while Congress tries to restore collective bargaining, DHS is escalating its efforts to eliminate it entirely for one critical workforce, TSA airport screeners.
This is an aggressive move.
It is. DHS announced a new labor framework on December 12th, set to be implemented in January 2026. This framework explicitly rescinds the existing collective bargaining agreement with the union representing about 47,000 screeners.
And what's the administration's justification for this?
It stems from a determination by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. She claimed that collective bargaining is fundamentally incompatible with TSA's national security mission,
saying it impedes agility and efficiency.
That's the argument. But a federal judge already blocked a similar attempt by her earlier this year.
Right, and that's key legal context.
A huge piece. The judge blocked the prior attempt just this past June, stating in the ruling that Noem's determination appeared intended to punish AFGE for pushing back against the administration's attacks. So the unions feel they have precedent on their side in this new fight.
This internal tension, it isn't just about labor. We have to mention the abrupt cancellation of that FEMA Review Council meeting late last week.
That was highly relevant. This council was supposed to announce recommended reforms for FEMA, an agency under intense scrutiny. The meeting was abruptly canceled on Thursday.
And the reason for the cancellation highlights this severe internal friction at the White House.
That's the core takeaway. White House officials were reportedly not fully briefed on the final report. Secretary Noem's office had apparently already slashed an initial draft from over 160 pages down to just 20.
So council members were worried key recommendations would be removed.
Or that recommendations they didn't endorse would be added. It just speaks to a structural chaos where politically aligned outcomes are prioritized over methodical policy development.
And that sense of chaos and the use of ideological litmus tests is manifesting acutely at the State Department.
Very much so. On Friday, the State Department retroactively promoted 200 Foreign Service employees. This came after the department unilaterally changed the promotion criteria earlier this year.
They eliminated what?
They eliminated any contributions to diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility DEIA goals from the criteria.
And what did they replace it with?
They replaced it with an assessment based on fidelity to the Trump administration's specific policy goals. The new precepts for promotion now explicitly require officers to demonstrate how they are zealously executing U.S. government policy.
And protecting executive power.
Right. It's an explicit shift toward ideological alignment over traditional diplomatic skills, and it's being done with an unprecedented lack of transparency.
How so?
The American Foreign Service Association, AFSA, is objecting because the department is withholding the names of the promoted employees and the identities of the promotion board members. They say it raises huge concerns about bias and favoritism.
All of this internal workforce turmoil, it has to be having a cumulative effect.
The psychological and operational strain is immense, and the numbers bear it out. The Office of Personnel Management's retirement inventory is just skyrocketing.
How bad is the backlog?
OPM is closing in on 50,000 retirement applications still awaiting finalization. They took in 23,000 applications in November alone. That volume is triple what they saw at this time last year.
So experienced federal talent is just heading for the exits.
A massive exodus. Uh-huh. The instability, the attacks on collective bargaining, the replacement of merit with ideology, it's driving experienced people out of the service and creating a huge institutional knowledge gap.
Let's pivot back to the high-stakes political and judicial landscape, which was dominated this weekend by the fallout from the Epstein files.
House Democrats delivered what's being called a preemptive strike on Friday, releasing photos of Jeffrey Epstein with President Trump, Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, and others. The news cycle today is still grappling with those images.
Why was the timing so strategic?
Well, Congress had passed a law compelling the DOJ to release its full, unredacted Epstein files by December 19th, just 4 days from now.
So by releasing these select photos ahead of that deadline,
they controlled the initial narrative. It complicated the White House's ability to control or redact anything in the official release. The White House, predictably, just labeled it a Democrat hoax.
And moving to the Supreme Court, they made news today with a consequential denial.
They did. The court denied to hear CANA provisions v. Bondi. And this decision reinforces the federal prohibition of interstate marijuana commerce.
What does that denial mean for the cannabis industry?
It means the judicial path to legalization is essentially closed for now. The entire sector is now forced to rely exclusively on the executive branch for any regulatory relief like rescheduling. It makes presidential action exponentially more powerful.
And that puts a huge spotlight on the other major constitutional discussions, particularly around the 14th Amendment.
Legal discussions today were heavily dominated by the implications of Trump v. Barbara, the case challenging the president's attempt to end birthright citizenship via executive order. That case will define a significant constitutional struggle of this term.
And we can't forget that the lawfare over the 2020 election is still running in parallel to all this.
It is. Today, a preliminary hearing was held in Wisconsin for two former Trump campaign attorneys and an aide facing felony forgery charges for the 2020 fake elector scheme. It's that strange duality, exercising supreme power in the present while former associates face prosecution for the actions that helped secure that power.
That bifurcated reality takes us neatly into the economic indicators and tech focus for the day, which saw stark contrasts in the market. Let's start with the tech sector, which is showing signs of deep skepticism about the AI boom.
Yes, despite the geopolitical anxiety, the tech sector had a severe specific plunge today. Analysts are calling it an AI correction. Broadcom shares plummeted over 11%, and that dragged down the whole semiconductor sector, including NVIDIA.
And this happened even though Broadcom beat its earnings expectations.
Exactly. So the problem isn't performance, it's a shift in market sentiment. It signals that investors believe the AI hype, the AI supercycle, has far outpaced tangible revenue. The market is shifting from growth at any cost to demanding immediate, quantifiable profitability.
And this correction comes despite the administration's recent efforts to bolster the sector.
Right. That executive order from Friday aimed at preempting state AI regulations. The president's rationale was that the U.S. is in a race with China and can't be stifled by a patchwork of onerous rules. It's an acceleration mandate for the industry.
But while tech slumped, another sector was soaring, driven entirely by anticipation of a major executive action.
The massive, unprecedented rally in the cannabis sector. Tilray was up 44%, Canopy Growth up 52%. This huge surge was driven by credible reports that the presidents are preparing to sign an executive order rescheduling marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3.
And this all comes down to a single, notorious provision in the tax code, IRS Code Section 280E. Can you break down why moving to Schedule 3 would create such a massive market impact?
This is the primary driver, and it's purely financial. Because cannabis is a Schedule I drug, like heroin, businesses dealing in it are subject to Section 280E. And this provision says that a business that traffics in Schedule I substances is prohibited from deducting ordinary business expenses.
So they're paying federal tax on their gross revenue, not their net profit.
Exactly. No deductions for payroll, rent, utilities. This creates an effective tax rate that can exceed 70% or 80%. It cripples their cash flow. If marijuana is rescheduled to Schedule 3, that prohibition under 280E instantly vanishes.
The financial relief would be enormous.
It transforms a company overnight. A business with $10 million in revenue and $8 million in expenses goes from being taxed on nearly $9 million to being taxed on its actual profit of $2 million. That single stroke of the executive pen creates billions in value.
Shifting to federal tech governance, we saw a significant development in cybersecurity enforcement.
Extremely notable. The Department of Justice is pursuing criminal charges against an individual employee related to the FedRAMP authorization process. This signals they're getting very aggressive.
The indictment charges a former Accenture employee,
Danielle Hilmer. The core allegation is that she concealed a cloud platform's non-compliance with security controls needed for the GSA's FedRAMP program.
And FedRAMP is the security assessment for any cloud service used by federal agencies.
Right. And the non-compliance here was fundamental. Hilmer was allegedly aware that system administrators lacked the necessary multi-factor authentication, MFA, to access the platform securely.
And she allegedly hid this.
Ignored internal warnings, submitted false representations, and the platform got a FedRAMP High Provisional Authority to Operate, a PATO.
Which means agencies believed it met the highest security standards.
And at least six major agencies, including the Army, were using it on contracts worth over $250 million. This criminal case is a huge wake-up call for the entire federal contracting space.
Meanwhile, GSA continues to secure major cloud deals to standardize and improve the federal tech posture.
Yes, they signed a new OneGov agreement with Tenable on Sunday. This is the third such deal this month. And it's significant because it offers agencies a massive 65% discount on Tenable's cloud security solution.
And looking ahead, the DoD is preparing for the next frontier in digital security.
Post-quantum cryptography, or PQC. The threat is that future quantum computers will be able to break current encryption, rendering almost all sensitive government data vulnerable.
So what's the immediate goal?
The DIDCIO is requiring all military services and agencies to immediately identify, inventory, and report all cryptography currently used in any system. They need a complete picture of their cryptographic exposure before the quantum threat becomes viable.
And finally, a recent GAO report is laying the groundwork for the government to move beyond simple generative AI
into something much more powerful, agentic AI.
And what's the difference?
Generative AI creates things based on prompts. Agentic AI systems are different. They're designed to sense, plan, and act autonomously based on predefined goals. It's the shift from asking an AI what it can create to asking what an autonomous AI can do.
So what are the immediate steps agencies need to take to prepare for this?
The GAO laid out a few areas. First, increase digital literacy. Understand your data landscape to ask the AI the right questions. Second, understand you're granting the system the power to act.
And where is agentic AI best applied right now?
It's ideal for routine, rules-based, labor-intensive workflows. Think document processing or compliance checks. It's valuable for triage and surfacing insights, but the report emphasizes that the final, critical decision-making should still be passed to a human.
Sam, this has been an absolutely comprehensive and critical 72 hours. If we zoom out, you can really see the pattern of three major synchronized shifts.
You can. We've witnessed the extreme militarization of foreign policy, symbolized by the Department of War. We've seen the systematic restructuring of immigration restricting humanitarian parole while accelerating wealth-based entry. And then the high-speed deregulatory push from the SBA strike force to the overhaul of NEPA with the SPEED Act.
Everything we've discussed, the executive orders, the court filings, the legislative agendas, it all points toward this massive consolidation of executive power and the active dismantling of long-standing structures.
That's the unifying theme, that desire for unilateral reconstruction. We talked about the demolition of the White House East Wing to build a ballroom. That physical act perfectly mirrors the policy efforts to dismantle the administrative state. The focus is entirely on a top-down, centralized vision of executive authority.
So if the entire focus of the executive branch is placed on this unilateral reconstruction, what happens to the essential complex functions of government? What about the urgently needed FEMA reform or ensuring compliance for critical systems like the ones in the FedRAMP fraud case?
That is the structural risk. What happens to the complex machinery of the state when the focus is only on the spectacle of centralized power?
That is the crucial question for you, the listener, to take away. What essential functions will atrophy when the institutional energy is entirely focused on unilateral action and top-down reconstruction? A perfect provocative place to leave our deep dives for today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.